There was no sound in the darkened theatre, except Isabella's sobs. These lasted for a long time. When they finally quietened, the lights were raised slowly, and Joseph Cicero came to stand over Isabella.
"I assure you that none of us takes any particular pleasure in this sort of thing. We will try to avoid any repetition."
"How could he do it?"
Isabella whispered brokenly. She was huddled down in the large chair.
"How could any human being do that to a child?"
"I repeat, we do not enjoy the necessity. You must blame yourself, Red Rose. It was your disobedience that caused your son's discomfort."
"Discomfort? Is that what you call the torture of an innocent..."
"Control yourself," Cicero warned her sharply. "For your child's sake, control your insolence."
"I'm sorry," Isabella dropped her voice. "It won't happen again. Just don't hurt Nicky again, please."
"If you cooperate, your son will not have to suffer further. He is in the care of a highly trained pediatric sister. He will receive the type of professional care that even you would not be able to give him. Later, he will be given the best education that any boy or young man can hope for."
Isabella stared up at him, her face twisted with misery.
"You speak as though he's been taken away from me forever. As though I'll never see my baby again."
Cicero coughed and shook his head, struggled to regain his breath, and then whispered hoarsely,
"This is not the case, Red Rose. You will be allowed to earn the privilege of access to your son. To begin with, you will receive regular reports of his progress. You will be shown video recordings of how he develops, when he first sits up unaided, when he begins to crawl, to walk."
"Oh, no," she whispered. "You can't keep him from me that long. It will be months."
Cicero went on as though she had not spoken.
"Later, you will be allowed to spend time with him each year. It is possible that sometime in the future, if your conduct is satisfactory, you will be allowed to spend holidays together. Days, even weeks in your son's company."
"No."
Her voice was a pitiful sob.
"You can't be so cruel as to keep us apart."
"Who knows? It is not beyond the bounds of possibility that one day we may remove all restrictions and allow you free access. For that to happen, you would have to earn our complete trust and gratitude."
"Who are you?"
Isabella asked in a small, subdued voice.
"Who is Ramon Machado? I thought I knew him so well, and yet I did not know him at all. Where is Ramon? Is he part of all this monstrous..."
Isabella's voice broke, and she could not continue.
"You must put aside all thoughts of that nature. You must not seek to find the answer to the question of who we are," Cicero warned her. "Ramon Machado is under our control, and do not expect help from him. The child is his also. He is under the same constraint as you are."
"What must I do?
What do you want of me?"
Isabella asked. And Cicero nodded with satisfaction. There had been a remote chance that the woman might prove headstrong and uncontrollable. The psychiatrist's report on her had mentioned that possibility, but Cicero had never placed much credence in it. The hook on which they had hung her was sharp and fiercely barbed. Even if the child died, they would find a replacement to act in the video games and keep her dangling on the hook. No, he had expected her to be compliant, and those expectations had been vindicated.
"First, I must congratulate you, Red Rose, on your doctorate. It will make your work for us easier."
Isabella stared at him. It was difficult for her to make the mental leap from this terrifying world of torture and espionage back to the prosaic consideration of her studies and academic honours. She had to concentrate to keep up with what he was saying.
"You will return as soon as possible to Cape Town and your family, after making arrangements at the university to receive your doctorate in absentia. Do you understand?"
Isabella nodded, not yet trusting herself to speak.
"On your return home, you will begin to take more interest in all the family activities. You will work to make yourself indispensable to your father. You will make yourself his assistant and confidant in all things, but especially in his new position as head of the Armaments Corporation. What is more, you will begin to take an active interest in South African politics."
"My father
is a self-contained man. He does not need me.
You are wrong, Red Rose. Your father is a very lonely and basically unhappy man. He is incapable of a lasting relationship with any woman, except your grandmother, his mother, Santon Courtney Malcolmess, and with you, his daughter. He needs that relationship very, very deeply. And you will give it to him.
You want me to use my own father? She whispered, horror blending with fresh horror in her eyes.
For the survival of your son,
Cicero agreed softly.
No harm will come to your father, but your son stands full in harm's way, unless you cooperate.
Isabella took a handkerchief from her handbag and blew her nose. Her voice was soggy.
You want me to inveigle myself into my father's confidence? To gain information on the National Armaments Program and pass it on to you?
You learn quickly, Red Rose. However, that is not all. You will use your father's political contact within the South African nationalist regime to foster your own political career within the party.
She shook her head. I'm not a political creature.
You are now, Cicero contradicted her. You have a doctorate in political theory. Your father will introduce you to the corridors of power.
Again she denied it. My father is in political eclipse. He backed the wrong horse when John Forster came to power in South Africa. That was why he was shunted into the ambassadorial post here, into political oblivion.
Your father has exonerated himself by the way he performed his duties here in London. His appointment to such a responsible position as head of arms corps is indication of that. We anticipate that soon he will be totally reinstated within the party. We deem it highly probable that within 2 years he will once more be a member of the cabinet. You, Red Rose, will ride upon his back. In 20 years from now, you yourself could be a minister of the government.
20 years?
Isabella echoed in disbelief.
Is that how long I must be your slave?
You still don't understand, Cicero asked, shaking his head. Let me explain it to you. You belong to us, Red Rose. You, your lover, Ramon Machado, and your son. Forever.
For many minutes Isabella stared sightlessly at the blank screen, contemplating the enormity of the vision that he had conjured up for her. Joe Cicero broke the silence. His voice was almost gentle.
You will be taken back now. They will leave you where they found you, on the embankment. Follow your orders, Red Rose, and in the long run it will work out well for you and your son.
The women attendants helped Isabella to her feet and led her to the door. When she had gone, the side door to the lecture theatre opened, and Ramon Machado stepped through.
You were watching?
Joe Cicero asked. And Ramon nodded.
I congratulate you, Joe murmured reluctantly. It has been well run. We may reap much of value from this operation. How is the child?
He suffered no ill effects. He and his nurse have arrived in Havana. Joe Cicero lit another cigarette and coughed and sat down heavily in one of the plastic chairs.
Perhaps, he thought, just perhaps, I will be able to leave the department in capable hands.
Amber Joy was about to fail to find. They could all see it. A palpable air of tension and expectation hung over the entire field of the trial. The South African Retriever Championship trial was being conducted over the foothills of the Kabonkelberg, along the western end of the Veldtevreden estate. The terrain was testing, and over the 2 days of the trials, the field of dogs had been whittled down to these four still in the hunt. The birds were mallard ducks, pen-reared on Veldtevreden, and placed in the field under the supervision of the judges prior to each retrieve. This would probably be the last occasion on which they would be allowed to use mallards, Shaza Courtney reflected. The conservationists were kicking up such a terrible stink about unshot mallards escaping into the wild.
There, these exotic birds were highly attractive to the indigenous yellow-billed ducks. Avian Don Juans, he smiled. The progeny of these illicit unions were hybrids, and the Department of Nature Conservation had proclaimed a ban on the release of mallards, which would become effective at the end of the month. Thereafter, they would be forced to use ringneck doves or guinea fowl, which was a pity, they all agreed. These terrestrial birds did not float well on the water retrieves. Shaza Courtney switched his full attention back to the retrieve in progress. Amber Joy was the main competition to Felder Friedan's hopes of carrying off the cup for the first time. Amber Joy was a splendid yellow Labrador. His sire had been American field trial champion for 3 years in a row. Up until now, every single retrieve that he had made during the last 2 days had been SOB, straight out and back. This time, fortune had turned against him. The mallard had risen from its cage and flashed away along the edge of the dam. Gary Courtney and Shaza were the field guns, chosen for the task because both of them were renowned shots. The mallard was flying left, Gary's side, and he had let it go to 50 yards before killing it so cleanly that it folded its wings and went in head first like a kamikaze. It fell close in to the reed beds amongst the lily pads and waterblommekies, the flowering aquatics that infested most dams in the Cape of Good Hope. The mallard's plunge drove it deep, and it had not re-emerged. Probably it was entangled with the plant stems below the surface of the muddy brown water. The judge had called Amber Joy's number, and Bunty Charles, his owner and handler, had sent him away. While the spectators crowded the dam wall to watch, the dog had taken to the water and swam out towards the spot where the mallard had disappeared. However, he had deviated from the true line as he swam, going up above the bird where any blood would drift away from him on the faint current set up by the inflowing river and the gusty southeaster which was sweeping across the open water. Now Amber Joy was paddling around amongst the reeds in erratic circles, occasionally ducking his head below the surface, but each time coming up with empty jaws, and a little further from the spot where the duck had plunged. His efforts were causing consternation on the bank. Bunty Charles was dancing from one leg to the other in frustration. If he whistled and redirected Amber Joy onto the fall of the bird, he would lose points. There was still no guarantee that Amber Joy would find even with this assistance. On the other hand, time was running out. The three judges were already consulting their stopwatches. Amber Joy had been in the water for over 3 minutes. Bunty Charles flashed an anxious glance at the next handler and dog in the line. Santon Courtney Malcolmess and Dandy Lass of Felder Friedan were his most bitter rivals. Up to now, he and Amber Joy had managed to hold them off, but only by 10 points. If they failed to find, they would certainly forfeit their hard-won lead. Santon Courtney was also under intense strain. She did not have Bunty's 30 years of field trial experience. She had taken to the sport only recently, yet she had brought all her immense energy and powers of concentration to it. Dandy Lass was the progeny of champions, a leggy golden retriever. She was bred for speed as a working gun dog, strong and wiry, unlike the heavier show dogs with their classical points of breed, but with their working instincts bred out of them. Dandy Lass had the heart and instinct to enter the heaviest cover or coldest water and work through it like a heroine. She had a fine nose to pick up the faintest scent of feather on the air, and her intelligence was uncanny. She and Santon had developed an almost telepathic rapport. Although she stood erect and utterly still, with her face calm and imperturbable, inwardly Santon was seething with agitation, and Dandy Lass picked it up from her. The judges would notice any word or gesture of restraint between them, and mark them down immediately. However, Dandy Lass was sitting on the live coals of her eagerness. Her fluffy golden bottom barely came in contact with the ground, and she switched from haunch to haunch with tiny excited movements not quite sufficient to incur the judge's wrath and penalty points. Whining or barking were grounds for instant elimination. With huge effort, Dandy prevented herself from giving tongue as she watched Amber Joy's frenzied efforts to find the bird. Yet her entire body shivered with eagerness, and the suppressed cries of excitement rumbled in her throat as she awaited her turn. Every few seconds she glanced up at Santon with imploring eyes, begging for the command to go. Shaza Courtney watched his mother from his place in the gunline. As always, she evoked in him the most profound sense of admiration. Santon Courtney Malcolm S. had turned 70 years old last New Year's Day. She had been named for her birth on the first day of the 20th century, and yet she was as slim and straight as a teenage boy. The outline of her legs and buttocks under fine woolen cloth were aristocratic and elegant. Who else would wear Chanel slacks to a field trial, he smiled, and her boots were of ostrich skin, handmade by Hermes of Paris.